This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Hospital floors can look pretty chaotic. If you've ever stayed in one or visited a loved one, you probably wonder if anybody's in charge. People in and out, machines hissing and beeping, electric lines and tubes running in all directions. Well, certainly there's a physician overseeing your case, but it is a nurse who's managing your care, seeing to it that doctor's orders are followed and paying close attention to your physical and emotional condition so that healing can actually happen. In the stress and chaos of a hospital stay, the role of the nurse is often dismissed.
I want another nurse.
Well, there are none. We're stretched pretty thin right now.
Then I want a janitor. They can do what you do, right?
Yep. Nurses and janitors are totally interchangeable.
Yeah, there it is. A clip from the sitcom Parks and Rec. So let us set the record straight. Nurses are in many ways the thread that stitches the hospital together. They connect patients and families and the medical team. This week is National Nurses Week, and we are celebrating with a roundtable of North Carolina nurses right here on the State of Things. Ann King is a family nurse practitioner at Wayne Memorial Hospital and a professor at East Carolina University School of Nursing. Welcome, Ann. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Leslie Sharp, a nurse practitioner at Sylvan Community Health Center in Snow Camp. Hi, Leslie.
Hey, thank you.
And Erica Saunders, a nurse at UNC Physicians Network, and she is the Triangle Regional Director of the North Carolina Nurses Association. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to try to get to your stories and talk a little bit about this profession. And I want to start with you, Leslie, because really a huge part of nursing is dealing with death. And we're mm-hmm. trying to avoid this. But this becomes a kind of a focal area. And when you were working as a nurse at Wright-Patterson Medical Center, you were sent to do military notification. Tell us about that job.
Well, it was actually a one time they needed help with a middle of the night notification. I was the nurse on call, and the medical officer who normally went could not go. And you always, when someone was being notified of a death in the family of a military member, they sent out a military officer, a chaplain, or a priest, and they sent out usually some medical person. And so I had never done it before. We had to ride about 3 hours to notify this family that their daughter had been killed in a domestic violence situation. And it's very set how you do it. The officer in charge can only read exactly what is on his paper, so that leaves the chaplain and the nurse to deal with the grief that comes with that notification. We got to the house at 3 o'clock in the morning, and when you open your door and you see military officers in full dress, you know something's wrong and it's not good news. And you don't always know what to say in that situation, but you do know how to be compassionate. And we just shepherded her in and sat down. I sat with her on the couch and just held her hand while the statement was read to her. And sometimes you don't have to use any words in that situation. You just have to be present and let them know through touch that you're there and that you feel their pain that they're having at that time.
This is an interesting situation for a nurse who's experienced this in other ways, when you really weren't there at the moment of death or weren't part of the mm-hmm. team, but somehow have to bring your experience and having had those conversations and being with people to someone who you honestly can't talk much to. You can't talk to them about the situation, right?
Right. We could not go into any detail. We did not have any other detail except what was provided. So you just go fully into the moment. You go into what does that person need at that moment. They need someone sitting with them, listening to them, letting them cry, seeing if there's anything more emergent that they need, whether it's physical, is there some sort of arrangement we need to do for safety. But everything just kicks in as to the same thing you would do in a hospital, the same thing you would do in a private practice setting or whatever, that you have to handle what's there at the moment.
And your first experience with death was with a patient in her 90s. Tell us about that.
Yes, sir. I'd probably been in nursing maybe 2 or 3 months. I was a very, very, very new nurse, and elderly lady, probably around the mid-90s, and her family had not, they didn't have any advance directives, living will, that type of thing, to make healthcare decisions for her. So when her heart finally stopped beating, we had no other choice but to perform full CPR on her. And I remember doing the chest compressions, and it was almost 30 years ago, just like it was yesterday, because it was so devastating that why are we doing this. And I felt, you know, as a nurse, we're patient advocate first. And so we did protocol what we were supposed to do. But since that time, living will is one of the first discussions that I have. Make a decision so you know what you want to happen. There's no doubt in my mind that she probably did not want us doing a full code on her, but we did what we had to do. But, you know, talk about those things ahead of time, extremely important.
Anybody who's heard the story you just told, it's quite obvious to them that your conclusion is a pretty good one. I'm going to make sure we have that conversation. Let's now take you to the front lines. You're dealing with a family who has a loved one who has a condition. It hasn't really sunk into them how critical it is, but you're pretty aware. And now you're the one who's talking about things they haven't considered before. How difficult is it to have that conversation?
It is extremely difficult, but this is something that we advocate doing way ahead of time. When I can still make decisions for myself, I need to make my wishes known to my family. They need to know what I believe. Should I become to the point that I'm kept alive by medicines, please do by or by machines, do not keep me alive. You know, if there's no hope, you know, have that conversation ahead of time so that the family knows, and then it becomes much more easy to make that decision. The family knows this is what mama would have wanted. This is what we need to do. But should you reach that point, then, you know, you lay out the facts to them, and then you just have to be there and give them time, let it absorb, take it one step at a time. There are professional organ donor people that are there that can help them. There's a lot of other agencies within the hospital, different professionals that can help with those decisions.
But you personally have to be ready for a potential blast. Somebody can come back at you and they can be angry, or they can have a level of grief that you personally need to be able to deal with, right?
Oh, yes. We have all the range of emotions that we see, from total despondency to extreme aggression. When you're faced with these life and death type of situations, everybody responds differently with different coping skills. So we just have to be aware, watch our people, listen to our cues, and you have to be in the moment. You have to be, you know, this is what I have to talk to this family about right now. I can't be thinking about, you know, do I have dog food at home? What's going to be for dinner? You know, did my husband pick up my child from soccer practice? You have to be in the moment. And I think that's what nurses are the best at.
And I think you also have to understand that sometimes these families feel you're giving up on them. You're giving up on their family member. And if you didn't give up, they would stand a chance to make it through. And so it is giving the best information that you have at that moment, and it is supporting them through it and helping them understand that when I explained to a family member recently, if we do CPR and it breaks his ribs and he makes it, he will have pain afterwards and he will be uncomfortable. And she goes, but I don't want him to hurt like that.
Mm-hmm. Erica, but I think you have a story, too, that it can shed some light on the difficulty of this. Your first experience with death as a professional, you had developed quite a bond with your patient, right?
Yes. Before I became a registered nurse, I was a certified nursing assistant working in a system of facility where we had a patient who was dying, and I had been with her for a year and she died, and I felt like that was a family member dying. And I stepped away and I cried myself. And what was so reassuring, my supervisor, she said, I'm so glad that you did release your emotions and didn't keep them bottled in, because she told me a story that oftentimes we as nurses, we just were focused on caring for the patient and we forget about ourselves and our emotions and our attachments to our patients. And she said, I'm glad that you let your emotions go, and because that you let it go, because you keep it bottled in, at one it could happen again, a patient may die, and then you'll have that outburst.
Right.
So at that time I cried and I let it go. I got myself together and I went back out and took care of my patient, got her ready to be picked up by the funeral home.
This brings me to what I think is the most sublime and important element of nursing, and that is what I would call professionalized intimacy. You can't be callous after this. Your remedy for the pain of someone else's grief can't be not to care anymore. So how do you learn? What is the professional skill of remaining intimate, careful about a human being, and still protecting yourself so that you can show up the next day?
Well, I think the most important thing is caring, and we do care. We do get very close to our patients. Leslie and I both did hospice, and part of that is helping them leave this life and enter another. And you do. There are many times that I cried with families because I cared about the person. But then you know that there's a beginning and an end to these professional relationships. And so you deal with your emotions personally. I may talk to a colleague about some unresolved feelings or some sadness, you know, in a situation that had a bad outcome. But that's part of being aware of yourself and setting the boundaries so that you don't become the family member, even though you're supportive of the whole family.
We're going to talk about this and much, much more as we continue our conversation about the profession of nursing today with three professional nurses. Anne King, a family nurse practitioner at Wayne Memorial Hospital. She's also a professor at East Carolina University School of Nursing. Leslie Sharp is a nurse practitioner at Sylvan Community Health Center at Snow Camp. And Erica Saunders is a nurse at UNC Physicians Network and the Triangle Regional Director of the North Carolina Nurses Association. Our conversation about this profession with these professionals continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with North Carolina nurses in celebration of National Nurses Week. Anne King, a family nurse practitioner at Wayne Memorial and a professor of nursing at East Carolina University. Leslie Sharp, a nurse practitioner at Sylvan Community Health Center at Snow Camp. And Erica Saunders, a nurse at UNC Physicians Network and the Triangle Regional Director for the North Carolina Nurses Association. I'm going to set up a false dichotomy here that I hate. That is a kind of distinction between scientific knowledge and sort of intuition or emotional knowledge. I don't like the distinction, but it's going to help us have a conversation about another aspect of nursing. And Terry, I'll start with you. A sense of intuition. There's a whole lot of technology now. We're strapped to a lot of monitors, a lot of numbers all around us. What's the blend of knowing how the body works? How often do you look at the numbers and say, I don't think that's what's happening in the patient, or that's not telling me the whole story?
Oftentimes, you can take the patient's blood pressure. You can draw labs. You can do all of those things. And sometimes it can give you a picture of what's going on with the patient. But then there's sometimes those things don't give you a picture. And you have an intuition within yourself. And you just say, something is not right with this patient. I can't put my finger on it. You do everything that you can do within your nursing assessment, the nursing process. And you just have that intuition. Something is not right. You assess the patient, and then you always call upon your nursing colleague and you talk to them. And then you go on and page your doctor or your mid-level provider and say, these are the things I've done. There's something going on with this patient. I would love for you to come and take a look. And you get them to the bedside and allow them to assess the patient.
Erica, can you think of a time when something like that has happened to you and you've really had to call people in?
So I remember working on an inpatient family practice, 11R Moore East. We were vascular surgery. We were a hodgepodge floor. I'll just put it that way. We got a little bit of everything.
That's the floor I always get put on. I'll send them to hodgepodge. They'll figure it out. So yeah.
And so there was a patient that I was caring for. And I came in, I worked night shift. And so I did my initial assessment, vital signs, went around, and I came back around to that patient and I was talking to the patient. And I said, you know, how are you doing? How are you feeling? And he was just like, I feel okay. And I said, okay. And I just kind of looked at his vital signs and then I looked to see what labs were done for that day. Usually labs are done early in the morning, and sometimes you'll have labs during the day. But for our particular floor, the labs were done early in the morning. I looked at his early morning labs. I looked to see what he was in there for. And just something inside internally was like, something is not right with this man. And he, you know, I went back around, checked again, and then I called upon my charge nurse and I said, can you take a look at this patient? Just tell me what you think. And she did the same process as I did, looked at the vital signs and looked at the labs. And she was like, I don't see any change. She said, do you feel like something is going on? I said, just something is not right with him. It's just, mm-hmm. I don't feel like he's not doing well at this time. So we called on, I was in a teaching facility. So you call upon the resident. So I called upon the resident. I asked him to come in and he looked and he said, well, why don't we draw some labs? Mm-hmm. We just draw some labs right now. We'll see what's going on at this time. And sure enough, drew labs. We did the comprehensive panel and the CBC. And this particular time, the man was bleeding internally. His hemoglobin mm-hmm. was dropping and bleeding internally. Mm-hmm. But essentially, when you looked at the labs from the morning,
right.
Oh, he mm-hmm. was beautiful. Nothing was wrong. Vital signs right. didn't show a drop in blood, because usually right. when a person who's bleeding, their blood pressure drops. His blood pressure wasn't dropping. So he's one of those patients you can't go based upon what you were taught in nursing
right.
school.
Right.
It's just that internal
right.
mm-hmm. intuition.
And, right. And by the time the low blood pressure shows up, he's lost a lot, right?
Right.
So that's kind of like when the oil light goes on, right? It's too late,
it's
or
too
it
late.
Can be. So, well, Ann, let me talk to you about this. So Erica called in the team looked, the resident said, let's draw more. Now, how often do you meet resistance? Because you don't have evidence. You don't have numbers. They've got a whole list of numbers here, and they're going to tell you, I don't care. I'm not going to do all that. Look at this person looks fine.
Well, again, essentially, we are the patient advocate, and that intuition's developed over years through professional training and experience. And, you know, as we teach new nurses coming on, we teach them to follow that instinct. And as a nurse practitioner, I am the bottom line. I'm the one that's going to be saying, well, you know, we need to do this and we need to do that. So when it comes, you know, we work together as a team, but I trust when that nurse says something's not right, I just don't have a good feel about that, because I've experienced that multiple times myself. Everything looked good on paper, should have been fine. Additional testing, you know, was not indicated, but something just said, you need to do one more step.
I'm going to try to cause trouble right now. You're a nurse practitioner now, so
yes.
you can prescribe and you can diagnose.
Yes.
As a nurse, you couldn't do that. And that meant that you had to get a resident or a physician to, okay. So how often is it and you drew on your experience, personal experience as a nurse.
Yes.
How often do physicians who don't have that experience find it difficult to draw another set of labs?
You know, if they are a physician that is in it for the right reasons, then they're going to do the right thing. They're going to listen to their nurse, because that's what we're there for. We know that patient better than anyone.
You had an experience with a woman who is, I think, going into labor.
Well, I worked in labor and delivery, and I was called to the emergency room for a labor check, to pick up a labor check. So we would go down there, pick them up, you know, bring them up to labor and delivery. Well, I walked down and kind of looked at her, and I, you know, how far along are you? 5 months. She thinks, maybe. What number baby is this? My fifth. And just, she had this look on her face. Oh, no, this is not going to make it up the elevator to, you know, two flights of stairs or, you know, two floors. And so we wheeled her into the emergency room. Luckily, I had an orderly there that helped me basically throw her up on the table. And we delivered the baby within about 3 minutes. So mm-hmm. just the look on her face, yeah. intuition said, this is not going to be good if we try this. So,
and, you know, I would say the majority of physicians out there really do a very great job of mm-hmm. listening. Those who have worked with nurses for a long time, they understand. And they know that they're trusting you. If you're the one that's doing mm-hmm. the bedside nursing in the middle of the night, or if you're the one out in the community working with them somewhere, I think that relationship between the physicians and nurses is good. There are sometimes you have someone who's a little newer, perhaps a little more arrogant, I don't know. And, you know, but they learn, and they understand after that, when they've had that episode of, you know, I've been telling you all night that this patient's just a little more anxious and something's not right. And sure enough, they'd had a heart attack that didn't show up on EKG or anything like that until the labs the next morning. And so they learn, but you earn that trust over time. You earn those communication skills.
Well, my mother used to say she trained an awful lot of doctors in her time. So this is the moment of full disclosure for me. The nurses in my family include my mother, my wife, my daughter, my daughter-in-law, and my sister-in-law. So I'm surrounded by them. And I will add that nothing I do is good for me. So that's the downside of having all these nurses. But also, I'm deeply prejudiced in their favor. And I have to say, when I go back to my mother's generation, and I know things have changed an awful lot since then, because now I have a daughter and daughter-in-law who do this, and they say that doctors are far better. But when I heard my mother talk about the kind of gymnastics and code that those nurses had to go through to save patients because you couldn't tell God he actually prescribed the wrong thing, things have changed. Things have changed. Mm-hmm. And I'm working through my prejudice. Full disclosure. That's all I just want to say. Leslie, we were talking about this intuition, and we've had two stories talking about working with patients, but you actually worked with a patient's family and, in a sense, had to test the boundaries between nurse and family at a certain point. Tell us about that.
It was a long time ago, and it's funny how there are some patients who are so incredibly vivid in your memory. But this was when I was a fairly new nurse. It was when I was in the Air Force at Wright-Patton, Dayton, Ohio, worked intensive care, and had a gentleman who had been quite sick for some time. And we were basically doing comfort measures at that point in the intensive care. He wasn't stable enough to go to the floor. We didn't really have hospice a lot at that time that we utilized. And the patient was... He just was taking a very long time to die, and his blood pressure was hovering very low in the 60s and 70s. And his family had come to me, and his wife said, "Why won't he die?" And I just, when you're in the room working with families, you hear things sometimes. And every time she had talked to him, she said, "I can't make it without you." And so all he was hearing was that she wasn't going to be okay. And so I wouldn't have said that on the first time she said it, but I'd been working with them for several days, and I told her that that's what I'd heard her say, and suggested that maybe if she and her son could go together and let him know that she would be okay. And she did, and he died several hours later. And this had been several days that it had been going on.
I mean, how long did it take you to work that through? Because this is a real important thing that you're about to say to somebody. And it's the idea of, I'm going to have to say this. I'm going to have to tell you that you're the one. You're in the way here, you know?
That, I can't say that there's always a lot of thinking. Sometimes the words are just given to you and they come out. And I'm a little surprised afterwards that I said certain things. And that can go both ways, because if you have a little bit of trouble with your filter, sometimes you say things that perhaps may not be so diplomatic. But I think these families know that you are there day in, day out for this person. They know it comes out of compassion, not out of meanness or anything like that. And you just, as nurses, we are forced to speak the truth.
Yes.
In as honest and compassionate a way as we can.
To speak the truth in an honest and compassionate way and in multiple languages, because you're talking with a medical team that has a vocabulary and a whole basis of understanding, a logic system, and families that don't really have that kind of background. Talk about the need to be able to be the translator, the communicator in that role, Erica.
Because we are nurses and we fall into various roles, and the average education for a patient is at a fifth or sixth grade level. And sometimes it's the same for the family members. And oftentimes doctors can come in, various people, doctors, occupational therapists, physical therapists, but doctors can come in and talk to the family members and talk to the patient about what's going on with their care. And just as soon as they walk out the door and you go in the door, what did he just say? Or what did she just say? I don't understand. What do they mean? And so you have to take that time to sit down eye level with the patient, with the family member, and explain to them, this is what's going on. This is what's getting ready to happen. Today, this is our plan. Or tonight, this is our plan. These are the things that this is the goal for you. This is what we're going to accomplish tonight. If we don't accomplish this goal, well then, next shift that comes on, I will give report to the nurse so that they know we need to continue this goal because we're going to complete this goal. And I will mention to the doctor that you had a question about this, you did not understand it, let's find some education. We'll find some education for you so that you can have understanding, because you want that patient and you want the family member to give you verbal understanding of what's going on, whether it's the medication, a treatment, home health. You want to make sure, because you do not want to send them home and they're in the unknown world.
The fact that that patient waited for the specialist to leave the room, who had just given him all that information, didn't ask them but waited for you, speaks to the bond of trust that you've already built up, right?
That is true.
I can talk to this person. They can understand. I'm just going to wait for them to leave. because there's a sense that there's no way that they can get it to me. I mean, maybe they can and maybe they can't. And I want to talk about some of the particulars of your work, because your family worked in tobacco. You work in rural areas now, right?
I did, yes. I grew up in a tobacco family, very rural. Jones County, the last county I lived in, about 10,000 people, but almost all agriculture. It's a way of life to us. So tobacco, that is our life. So working in the rural areas is different, because you need to understand the special challenges of farmers and farm families and migrant farm workers, because they could present with a set of symptoms that you might think is a simple case of bronchitis, but it's truly not. It's related to lung damage from being in a chicken house, or, you know, a little bit of nausea, some dizziness, and you may think, you know, they're coming down with something benign, and it could be green tobacco sickness, it could be pesticide poisoning, could be heat exhaustion from being out there. So there's a lot of variables to understanding the rural population, but the biggest group, hardworking people, would, you know, they're the ones that, you know, they're hemorrhaging and they slap a little duct tape on it and keep right on going. That's what we do. Yeah. So tough stock.
And you actually had a personal connection with this in terms of those illnesses, because your family grew up with tobacco, right?
That was our summer job. If we weren't in school, we were working in the field. So our summer jobs, which were great because we actually earned a little bit of money, but it was rather frequent in the beginning when we were starting to harvest the tobacco that we would get sick. We knew it. We felt bad, you know, but it's like, just tough it up, you know, drink a little bit more water, you'll be okay, type of thing. We just kept going because that's what we do. But it truly was green tobacco sickness. It now has a name, and we know some ways to prevent it. We know it happens and we know how to treat it. So we've come a long way, but it's being out there and understanding them and understanding their language and what they're doing to make a difference.
Some of that understanding can come from personal experience, picking tobacco as a summer job, but you can't have experience in every field that every one of your patients has. Leslie, how important is it to know the personal stories, the personal histories of your patients?
Oh, I think it's crucial. I remember working in intensive care, and I would be so frustrated that a patient was coming back in again and again for the same thing. And we're nurses and we're compassionate. That doesn't mean we're not judgmental sometimes. And you would say, why aren't you doing what I told you to do at home? Why aren't you keeping a clean environment? Until I started doing home-based nursing. And when you get in the homes and you understand what these people are trying to deal with and what they are trying to cope with, and it is beyond anything that they may not have indoor plumbing, they may not have electricity, and that's in this area. It's not just rural areas. You know, it can be some of the areas I worked are around downtown Durham. And people are doing the best that they can. And if you will take that step back and get to know why there's a problem and what their story is, it's one step closer to helping them solve it and figure out what other ways can we become involved.
And I would think that's a particularly challenging, Erica, for, you know, people who, you know, you talked about a patient saying, what did they just say? If part of the prescription, if part of what they're supposed to do is to get some help that you know isn't even available to them, I mean, what do you do next? And how often does that happen?
That's where you outsource. You get social work on board. You get case management on board. And working in an inpatient setting and in an outpatient setting, when you're assessing your patient, there are certain questions that you ask them. Do you have running water, electricity? Is there any type of issues at home? Because if you have those issues at home and you send the patient back to those issues, as Leslie said, they'll come back. They will be returning. So while you have them there, get them connected with social work, get them connected with case management, so that if they need help paying their electric bill, they need help paying their water bill, or if they need food, if they need assistance with prescriptions, you can get those people on board so that before they are discharged or before they leave your clinic or what have you, you have a plan.
Another talent in taking that history is reading between the lines, because I'm guessing if you ask anybody, are you having any trouble at home, the answer is always no. So it may be the gap between the question and the answer or some other intuition you have about how that's answered. A lot of skills required for this profession of nursing. Erica Saunders, a nurse at UNC Physicians Network, Triangle Regional Director of the North Carolina Nurses Association. Leslie Sharp, a nurse practitioner at Sylvan Community Health Center. And Ann King, a family nurse practitioner at Wayne Memorial and a professor of nursing at East Carolina University. More of the state of things ahead. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Ann King is a family nurse practitioner at Wayne Memorial Hospital and a professor at East Carolina University School of Nursing. Leslie Sharp, a nurse practitioner at Sylvan Community Health Center at Snow Camp. Erica Saunders is with us as well. She is Triangle Regional Director for the North Carolina Nurses Association and a nurse at UNC Physicians Network. Leslie, tell us, you mentioned that you did hospice work in downtown Durham in the 90s, I guess. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that work.
Oh, it was pretty remarkable. I had come from intensive care nursing where we had all the fun equipment and all the high technology, and going into working, it was with Triangle Hospice at the time. I think they're now with Duke. And you have to learn a lot, and you have to learn to think differently, to process differently, and talk on a whole different level. And I was just very fortunate and amazed and awed at the patients I worked with at the time, that while so many had so little, they were doing incredible things.
And you also have to do things that are not always – I mean, it's interesting to shift from saving the patient to allowing them to make a transition. Mm-hmm. And it should be on a continuum, but it seems to me that's on or off, right? I mean, we're either saving them or we're letting them go. Is that a big transition for medical personnel to have to make?
I don't know. I think we were talking, anyone who's done intensive care or floor nursing or anything has had that patient that far too much has been done, that perhaps they didn't have their advanced directives, and they are just getting everything thrown at them, and there you can tell the patient's exhausted and possibly dying. You can tell the family is exhausted and just so anxious, and there comes a time even in that setting where someone has to start advocating, have we perhaps done enough? And could we start thinking about taking care of this person in a different way? And often, it was really amazing. You would remove all the IVs and the medications and all that. And actually, the patient started getting better sometimes, didn't always heal fully. But they had this time of being better, time that they could talk to their family and maybe say goodbye. So I think we do it on both sides, even in the high technology. But in the home, I had to learn it's actually not always preparing someone to die. It's actually teaching someone or letting someone show you how they're going to live until they die and listening to that when perhaps you had a different idea.
Well, you had a pretty good story about that. tell us that. This had to do with, I think it had to do with the Salvation Army as part of the story.
It did. We had a gentleman, I'll call him Murphy. He was so funny. And his entire family, very low educational level, very low socioeconomic status. And when we started working with him, his wife did not even know how to give the Tylenol. She would call us, so it was very time intensive for on-call staff, because she would call and say, what do I do? Well, at that point, he wasn't on heavy-duty narcotics, so it was just teaching the Tylenol. We had an amazing team at Triangle, with the nurses, the social workers, the chaplain, and the volunteers, and somebody... I was there most every day, but somebody was in the home every day checking on this family, even on the weekends. And we brought them so far, and old Murphy, he decided he had some things he wanted to do. Even though I thought perhaps he wasn't going to be able to do them, he said, no, your job is to make sure that I can do them. He wanted to be Santa Claus for the kids and do the bell ringing for the Salvation Army. And he wanted to go to this camp, and he wanted his picture in the newspaper. And so we actually were able to help facilitate all of that. And he went on much longer than Christmas and all that stuff. And by the end, his wife was handling very complex narcotic management. She was bathing him, changing him. The entire family had come so far. And it was one of those amazing experiences.
Did he decide this in January? Maybe it was just a ruse to live another whole year. I want to be Santa Claus. That gets me to December. And then we'll go from there.
We started in, I think we started with him in the fall.
Okay.
And then he lived, I would say, up until the springtime.
Huh? Well, a lot of this, and Eric, I know you've been on both sides of hospice care and seen it from both sides. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that experience from both sides.
As my family member, my aunt, who has been dead for a year, hospice came in pretty much preparing us for her transition. And it was a blessing to have them a part of our family to help with the transition, to help my uncle, to help her children prepare for her transition. During her last days, she wanted a Wendy's, I want to say icy, it's not an icy, a Frosty. Excuse me, a Frosty. She wanted a Frosty, got her a Frosty. She asked for a family pastor, got the family pastor. Just getting prepared, preparing her last arrangements, having hospice there meant the world. And I just admire hospice nurses mm-hmm. because it takes a special person.
Did it change the way you approach nursing on the floors or in your practice?
Oh, yes. And every situation is a learning situation. And what I took from it is let people live out their days, whatever they want. Even if my aunt just ate two spoonfuls of that Frosty, mm-hmm. but she had it.
Mm-hmm. How much of that, Ann, is it seems to me one of the things we lose in a hospital room is control, mm-hmm. certainly. When that surgeon puts in a new hip, they really don't want you helping as the patient, and they want that hip to stay there. So they've got some very specific instructions about what you should and should not do. And you get that. But the patient then sort of slowly gets the message that they're not in control of themselves. And you heard Leslie say once we pull some of the cords, people seem to brighten a bit. How do you balance that to give a patient a sense of control, if that is a value, but also, you know, be in charge because there's things you don't know and there's things that you'd really better leave to me. That sounds like a tough job.
Sure. And part of what we do is keep the patient and the family in the driver's seat and listening to them. And there's so many things that they do have control over. And I think the biggest thing that we do is instilling hope and letting them know, whether it is hope for a peaceful transition, hope to check off some things off the bucket list. You know, if you're in hospice care, we've all done that. I mean, that's part of our goal. Or hope that, you know, we are going to give you what we can do, but these are the things that you do have control over. And there's a lot of things that even the patient in the hospital room and that family still has control over. And part of that is just begins with communication and open dialogue, asking the tough questions and letting them know, you know, you can do A, B, C, D, and E on your own, and this is going to help you improve, regardless of the restrictions that have been placed, because we don't want you moving and twisting and you're not going to be running down the hall while you're here, but this is what you can do. And I think recognizing that and helping the patient set their own goals within the guidelines that were given.
But again, that speaks to that bond of trust, because really the physician or others have to be sort of command hierarchical. And so somebody has to be the bridge and say, yeah, but there's something you can do. And they have to believe you. It's hard for me to detach and say, well, when do I trust the expert? And once I let go, you know, it's like, well, take care of me. You know, put something in, read the dial, and give me another one of those pills, right? And then you have to say, oh, okay, but you can ask for the pill. If you don't feel the pain, you don't have to have the pill. That seems to me the hardest thing to manage.
I think about people who do post-op care or surgical care. And, boy, my admiration and respect goes out to those nurses, too, because when you have someone who has either had a major cardiovascular surgery, you know, their chest, they've got issues, or even having to get up and walk, and the patient doesn't want to do that, where we can help is, I know you don't want to do that. You know, you have to do that to improve. But can you, when do you want to do that? So we give choices where we can. We do a lot of teaching.
What is it that we heard that clip in the beginning of the show where the sort of they wanted a janitor because they were doing what a nurse does, which to me means we don't have enough respect for janitors, because actually it's kind
yes.
of true. But that's not, what else have you discovered in your careers that people just misunderstand or don't know about nursing, Erica? I'll start with you, that you'd like them to know about this profession.
The one thing I think the misinterpretation in regards to nursing that I think we were discussing, we don't practice medicine. We practice nursing. We are nurses. We go to school to become registered nurses, and that's what we practice. We have our own board that governs us. We have our own professional organizations. We have our own scope that we have to follow and uphold. And that's who we are. And I think sometimes people do get that misinterpreted that, oh, you all practice medicine. No, mm-hmm. we don't.
Mm-hmm. Leslie?
What I think people need to know about nursing is it is probably one of the broadest careers out there. You can do anything. And it
so
is
true.
Amazing that we are trained and you're given kind of your basic training, like the military. But then you go out and you get further training on the job. And you can go into outpatient setting. You can work in intensive care or the burn unit. You can do hospice or home health. You can do work in the operating room. You know, all of these require such amazingly different skills and personality types. So you can do anything. And I think nurses can do anything. I think they're pretty amazing people.
And some of it is more technical than others. It's not
yes.
all. I mean, if the sort of interpersonal skills is not highest on mm-hmm. your inventory, there are great professions and specialties out there that mm-hmm. allow for that as well. Well, what about you, Anne? What would you say we need to know?
Well, I think the biggest challenge now is that there are a lot of professionals involved in healthcare, and we all have to work together as a team with the patient and family in the driver's seat, and not removing, you know, talking around the patient and the family and making sure that we are communicating with amongst ourselves so we're not duplicating repetition or missing a big piece of the puzzle. A lot of professions out there, and interprofessional care is really mm-hmm. what we have to do.
Yes.
The industry is changing quickly, owing, I think, a lot to just the science and what we know. How is that changing the field of nursing? I'll stay with you, Anne.
Well, I think we are, as nurses, a key driving force. We are pretty much the largest profession, and so we're everywhere. Any place that there's healthcare, you're pretty much going to have nurses. And so I think it's important that we listen to each other, respect all the other professions, and integrate the care into the holistic care that we can plan with the patient. But, you know, being that patient advocate is the most important thing utmost. And then just because we can do it, should we do it? We have to think about that. When there's all these extraordinary measures that we can do, are they really appropriate? And helping families make the best decisions at the time.
What about that? Is there a kind of an incremental sort of responsibility creep that nurses are having more and more responsibility stacked on them without sort of, and it can come from all directions.
Mm-hmm.
So is it becoming an impossible job?
I think it depends where you work and the administration that you work with. I think that there are some places that as a nurse you have a whole lot more control. I think sometimes in the hospital settings on inpatient floors with large patient numbers, you could be asked sometimes what you're physically capable of doing in an 8-hour shift or 12-hour shift is just so stretched beyond belief, and new requirements through the word meaningful use. Mm-hmm. Most healthcare professionals know that, that you're just required to do so much more in that time. And sometimes it feels like you're stepping away from what it's about, from that patient care. So it can get overwhelming at times.
As medical care, I mean, I will just assert that medical care, in a sense, medical profession is gendered, whether we want it to be or not. If I say doctor, you're probably going to think of a man. And if I say nurse, you will probably think of a woman, even though many more women are practicing medicine now and there are male nurses. But is our perception, if I'm right about that, our perception of gendered profession in any way must make it a struggle, does it make it more difficult? Do people see nursing as women's work and, by extension, less important?
I don't believe it's less important in any means. And when you say doctor, well, I am a doctor. So that is my professional title, and that's what I use in my profession. Physicians being more male-dominant, traditionally, yes, that's the way it's been. But as I don't believe that it's a power grid as much as it is a difference in the role. We see the key information might maybe coming from the physician in the hospital setting, but we know where the care is truly coming from and that we put all the pieces together as nurses.
Do you see the perception or possibly the perception of that as kind of a gendered profession as any kind of a liability or an obstacle for nurses?
I would say at this time, no, there's no liability. And I have seen with nursing the change of it being a woman's profession mm-hmm. as anyone's profession, mm-hmm. male or female. Now more and more you can see in the schools of nursing, males, mm-hmm. a number of males are going to nursing school. And even now, when you are in the inpatient, outpatient settings, there are a number of male nurses. So males are coming in strong right. because they are seeing, as Leslie mentioned, there's so many variables to nursing. You don't have to be in the inpatient. You can be in the outpatient, or you can be in medical communications. You can do research. There's so many variables now that you can go into a nursing, and I think that's what's piquing the interest of male and female.
All right. Leslie, do you think?
I don't feel like, I guess I don't perceive of it now as a male-female thing. When my mom, when I was growing up and deciding what to do, my mom I was a nurse, and I knew she loved it, but she tried to talk me out of it because she felt like it did not get the respect it deserved as a nursing profession. However, you can't take away the fact that she loved it. And maybe when I started, there was a degree of that. But I have found over the years that it's really this great relationship of mm-hmm. colleagues. Even though, yes, you can have some physicians who drive you nuts, you can have nurses who drive you nuts, you can have janitors who drive you nuts, it can be anything. So I don't feel the gender part. I just feel we're still working on letting people practice fully to what they should be able to do.
I want to thank all of you for your hard work and for your conversation today. Leslie Sharp, a nurse practitioner at Sylvan Community Health Center in Snow Camp, and King family nurse practitioner at Wayne Memorial, and a professor at East Carolina University School of Nursing, and Erica Saunders, a nurse at UNC Physicians Network and the Triangle Regional Director of the North Carolina Nurses Association. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was great.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Our producers are Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley, the technical director. Brent Wolf, the news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.